Good morning, Watkins Glen and Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and I'm Eric Clay, your host, and our guest on this hour is Tom Russetti. Tom, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good to have you here.
Thank you for
now,
inviting me.
The way we normally start these conversations is just to get a little bit of a sketch, a thumbnail sketch, either a story that kind of is helps to open up your life, or just kind of a list of things about you that people need to know as a starting point. But sometimes it's a good story, and sometimes it's some labels. It is whatever you want it to be.
Okay, a story doesn't come to mind so much, but it might be helpful to say that I've worked as an engineer and technical person really most of my life, have worked for a lot of years on alternative energy kinds of things and renewable energy sorts of topics, and have pursued that kind of career over the years pretty successfully, and with some interesting interludes. There was a period of being a glider flight instructor for a number of years and things like that. So I've tended to have the poles of really rational, focused work, and then other aspects that were, you know, just don't fit that mold at
right,
all.
Right. A little bit of an adventurer.
Yeah, and then in some ways that way, yeah. And I come from an Italian-American family, and we've carried a lot of those traditions through over the years. And the winemaking continues, the biscotti continues, and come from a small industrial town in southwestern Pennsylvania that was, you know, very ethnically and racially diverse. It was really diversity before we thought about how to create it. And
It was. There were many of our eastern cities.
It was just an extraordinarily rich, gritty, cultural upbringing that persists to this day and still carries through.
So. Really? So it was able to survive the evisceration of manufacturing in many of those areas?
I should clarify. Yeah, the impression of it persists to this day in my mind. But economically, no, it's really in dire straits in that area.
Right. But it... that gritty, few embellishments, or if there are embellishments, they're for the support of the story. That kind of gritty place without a lot of pretension is a very powerful place to come from.
Yeah, that's correct.
Good. Now, you brought some music, and you brought what's different today is that you brought music that's your own, and at least some of it. And so we're gonna cut to your first song. Do you want to say something about that?
Just a bit. It's just music that was recorded spontaneously with friends. I play, essentially fiddle tunes in the Southern Appalachian tradition. I play mostly, mandolin and tenor guitar, but also some fiddle. I'm not the fiddler on these tunes, but it's just playing with friends. It's something I do a lot.
Good. Does this song have a title?
Can't remember which one that is.
Let's go ahead and bring it up.
Thank you.
And you're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Tom Russetti. And Tom, you're a fiddler, you're an engineer, you've been a glider teacher, as you were saying before. But what are the experiences that have helped to shape who you are as a person? What has kind of guided, what kind of launched you? What are the things that have launched you into this world?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, being just a little over 57 years old, there are a lot of experiences that have been pivotal and important. As I reflected on this, I was I was realizing that one of them was back in 1980, after a stint of work in Detroit in the auto industry, which was a tough place to be then and maybe even is still now. Right. With some friends, I rode a bicycle from near Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where I grew up, out to the West Coast. And it took about 7 weeks or so. And I remember discovering that people were fundamentally friendly. Uh-huh. And that came after growing up in the turbulent 60s and 70s and a lot of racial tension in Pittsburgh and other areas in that period, and then being in Detroit. And so had, you know, a lot of fear built up, and then found out with 6 or 7 weeks of just rubbing shoulders with people, you know, in such a simple, benign way that people fundamentally are friendly.
Right. Right, especially when they see you as non-threatening and perhaps a little vulnerable.
Yeah.
That's powerful.
That was one. Mm-hmm. Another one that really shaped me and changed my career was somewhere maybe about 10 years after that, I was involved in a group that ended up suing the Army over an environmental issue. And that's a long story. But the short version of it is that in the process of that legal case, we learned a lot more about our government and how it works than I ever wanted to learn.
Right. Well, what was the issue that you were suing over?
It was the sighting of a helicopter base near a natural area, sort of within a natural area, and there had been concerns that the environmental assessment had been cooked,
right.
And so, you know, we just ran with it. And it was a really interesting experience with a wonderful pro bono attorney who went on to some landmark cases and things like that. But it was a real eye-opener. And it's things that people are realizing now with all the discussion about what the NSA does and Snowden and so forth. I mean, these are things that we learned through the discovery process back in, you know, 1990 or something. Mm-hmm. And pretty eye-opening.
Right. Right, but and not unlike the group that invaded the FBI files outside of Philadelphia, and you know where they discovered all of these
all that stuff.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. So I take from this you have learned a certain amount of generosity and friendliness, but also a skepticism or a wariness. How do those two experiences play into your life?
I think there's a constant tension. Mm-hmm. And as I've talked with more people, I realize that we're probably all like that. We have these polarities within us that are, you know, our acculturation, our held views, our desire to open contrasted against our desire to protect ourselves and close down and so forth. And you know, when you said I learned generosity, I think that's a progress. That's a work in progress.
Yeah.
I observed people being generous and said that's something worth learning, you know. And on these other issues, you know, it's really interesting. I think that what we discovered as a group is that there are some things that are worth fighting for. I'm not necessarily saying physically fighting for, but principles that are worth taking a stand for. And speaking for myself, I learned that that's a really uncomfortable, public, visible process. And it was an extraordinary group of people with whom I could talk about these kinds of things.
Right.
And I think one of the things about our society and our the way we portray these things in media and movies and so forth is that sort of trying to do the right thing is easy and will feel good. And I think what I learned is that trying to do what you perceive to be the right thing may not be the right thing, but you try it anyway.
Right.
And that it usually involves a fair amount of inner struggle.
Turmoil.
Yeah.
There's a lot of writing in recent months and years on how kind of rampant idealism tends to disappoint us and lead us to apathy fairly quickly. And in your experience, you had to let go of some of the idealism fairly quickly. And so what about that process made you feel so vulnerable? I mean, or why weren't you prepared? What about life made that almost a surprise to you? I grew up in a small town where, you know, we have our own personal stuff, but the assumption is that it's never just your stuff. Somebody somewhere has got it too. So, you know, there's no presumption of privacy, but there is a presumption of self-determination. And that presumption of self-determination means you kind of enter the public square knowing it's going to be awkward and people are going to not necessarily be nice, but that's the way community is. And that's the way holding the government accountable kind of is. And what made this a discovery for you?
Oh, that's a good question. I think the discovery part was learning that the government, an ideal that I held in some way, didn't play fair.
Right.
So that was
there. So you expected them to play fair, and darn it, they weren't.
Yeah, they were the guys in the uniforms that protect our country and you know, all those kinds of things mm-hmm. that we, you know, essentially agree to culturally in a country like mm-hmm. ours. And so that was a big letdown. And then, you know, the other aspect about it was that that as we dug more into it, there was not actually an absolute right and wrong. I don't know if I'm answering your question, but
this is getting at it. Yeah,
that it became harder to be entirely right the more mm-hmm. I got to know the people wearing those uniforms.
Right.
And it became harder to hold them entirely wrong, and it became, you know, more clear that we were all part of a system, and that there was a role for them, and there was a role for the dissenting voice as well.
Right.
But all of that is, you know, I'm speaking in hindsight, so all of this was sort of discovering itself, you know, in the process of going through this, and probably the most personally uncomfortable thing for me and for my, you know, comrades in dissent there at the time was that you know, our view was not, well, it was in rural central Pennsylvania, and our view was not popular.
Right.
And so to take a stand in that way publicly, visibly, puts you in some sort of personal risk, whether you
right.
you feel like it is.
Right.
So, yeah.
And it heightens the fact, I mean, there are a couple of myths that are play. One is that the government necessarily plays fair, or the other myth, which I think is even more foundational, is that peace is the absence of conflict. Or that the good life is the absence of fundamental threatening conflict. And I think we deceive ourselves and our children and everyone when we're not prepared for the fact that peace is living through these tensions. You need the government side and you need the dissenters, and they're not completely right and wrong, and you're not completely right or wrong, but in the tension there's something produced, and that tension is life.
That's a really great point. I grew up in a family where my father was a strong and public and dogmatic figure.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, we always believed he was on the side of right. He was a union organizer, and he was an educator advocating for better educating standards and teacher standards and things like that. But, you know, his style of approaching it didn't really embrace what you're saying. It wasn't necessarily that you really needed both sides, and it always seemed like there would be a point where he would win and then the tension would dissolve, but that's just not the way life works.
Right. You know? Right. But in the mid 20th century, when you're talking about mid to late 20th century, those fights in some sense were at least temporarily winnable. And modernity, the whole process of making things more scientific and more rationalized and more public policy, gave us the false hope that we could solve our problems rather than live with them. And sometimes the living with them is the more creative outcome. My father was a person who was both admired because he could help sort out the kids who were in trouble, the young boys. He was a scoutmaster, and guys would, you know, the banker would send his son because his son was messing up in serious ways, and my dad would kind of just listen to him and hang out with him and do work with him, and he began to give him a bit of a stable rudder in life that his father couldn't, and he could trust my dad. But my dad was not appreciated because he didn't make a living. He didn't farm the way. He farmed in 19th century ways, which were more in tune with, well, not even so. He farmed with ways that were more in tune with the long-term sustainability and of the land and the harvesting of wildlife off of the land as well as farming it. So it was a more integrated process. Yeah. I don't mean to pull away here. We have lost the idealism of modernity, and has left us hurt and wanting for more realistic things. But you seem to have found an approach, or are discovering an approach, as you were saying, with generosity. The bike trip helped you learn that generosity was important, but it's a lifetime of learning what it means.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I agree with that. Yeah. That's definitely an ongoing.
Yeah. Let's cut to some music. What would you like to cut to next?
Why don't you go to the CD with Tommy Jarrell? It's to your right there, and the reason I brought that one up is I've selected some music that sort of represents a bit of the trip through the history of Southern old time music here. Mm-hmm. And Tommy Jarrell was an old North Carolina fiddler. He was one of the old guys, not one of the oldest, but pretty close to it. And these tunes have been collected, and Ithaca has been a real interesting revival of all that, and that music grabbed me when I moved here, and so he's one of the earlier.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. And the name of this piece is Cumberland Gap.
Cumberland Gap is one of the classics.
Tumbling gap, wake up, sober in the tumbling gap.
that's Tommy Jarrell and Cumberland Gap. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Tom Russetti. And Tom, during the music break, you were saying that you might want to pick up on those issues of conflict and connection.
Mm-hmm. You brought up the point of you know, being lulled into apathy with a false idealism, and that maybe just the, you know, in the actual conflict is life, and that's something I've been exploring a lot lately. And you know, from a familial perspective, I think my dad's approach to conflict, you know, was, again, he wanted to win, he wanted to prevail. He was real sure that the ideals he held and were defending were the right ones in a given situation. And so, like all of us, you know, I carried a lot of what my parents, you know, taught me in those ways. And so I carried a lot of righteousness into life and every aspect of work. And one of the benefits of living 57 years is it wears down your certainty.
Self-righteousness and certainty, yes.
It has a tendency, yeah. And lately what I've been finding, you know, is that just about everybody holds the same view, that people with passion are expressing that passion because they believe it fits their needs at the moment, or they believe it's right, or they, you know, want it to prevail, and we all share that. And it can be in as simple as technical debates. Mm-hmm. I've worked for a long time in scientific and engineering fields, blessed with wonderful colleagues who had strong ideas about what was right and wrong, and you know, and so you debate and you passionately argue these things out and test them. In business, you know, I'm working right now partly as a consultant, partly in the solar industry, and when you're dealing with people and customers, mm-hmm. misunderstandings arise, and you work things out and all those kinds of things, or you don't work them out. And what I found has been happening over time with a few experiences feeding them has been a desire to sort of move more toward conflict rather than move away from it.
Yeah.
And it's this may be almost the first time I'm verbalizing it, but I've found that if you begin to move toward, try and understand where the other person's coming from, try and understand where you're coming from, what's the intensity of my own emotions and this kind of thing, there's just something happens. And what I'm beginning to really value is trying to maintain some human connection even in the most heated of disagreements.
Right.
You know, one good example is, you know, we're in the midst of Solar Tompkins.
Yes, yes.
And the run-up to that program was pretty interesting for those of us in the business. On the one hand, we have a group of citizen activists who are really passionately dedicated to increasing the amount of solar PV on rooftops. That's a good thing. And on the other hand, we have a business, which is, you know, a business environment, which is increasingly going to the larger, more corporate installers.
Right.
It's a tendency, just like in other areas, segments of our economy. And we have a few local installers here who, as this was developing, felt threatened. We felt threatened in a sense of, could we compete? Could mm-hmm. we be part of this program? What would happen if we were left out? And there were high feelings on both sides. Mm-hmm. And we've talked since more, both sides, and as the program's been evolving successfully, we've had more opportunities to talk to each other. But I began to realize through that it was, you know, it was possible to have very strongly held viewpoints with factual and good idealistic underpinnings on both sides.
Good evidence to support,
yeah. And how easy it is to lose connection with the other person,
right,
the other side. But yet how, I don't know, what's the word? I don't know, richness doesn't even begin to describe it. But when you reach across and, you know, and have a beer with the other
right,
side,
right,
and sit down and realize that under it all, you both want the same thing. You want a lot of solar on the roofs.
Right.
And you listen to what the fears and concerns and goals of each side were, and just something happens in that listening process out of the conflict. And I'm almost tempted to say that more happens out of that than if the conflict hadn't been there originally.
Right.
And it seems completely counterintuitive, but
Let me say something I've never said in public. A fight is often not about what's to be won, but it's one of the few times we really get to demonstrate our fears in public. And when we get our fears out there, which is what we're willing to fight for, we often have to be more real than when we're postured or restrained, and we don't know each other, and we make moves that keep things obscure or hidden, like the government may have been doing in a case in Michigan, but or in central Pennsylvania. One of the things that if you give up the trappings of propriety and are in a fight, you're somewhat out of control, and the other person is, without having to be outrageous. And there's a point where being in good, healthy conflict produces more knowledge, more empathy, more understanding, and more possibilities than if we avoid it. And I think that's what you're saying. Part of me as a young kid was learning that a lot of people just want to be engaged. And the only way that they really know how to engage is through awkwardness and fighting and demanding. And in that situation, I don't need to win, but I need to find a way to engage them and then talk it back down. And in the schoolyard, the old saying that I had was, I don't need to win the fight, but I need to engage them and stop the fight so that we can actually take each other serious. Because if I win all the time, I'm just another bully. And I don't want to be another bully. But we have very precious things here, which are embodied in our fears and our tendencies to act hurtfully or badly at times. But they often, underneath them, are some really precious stuff or some common values. Am I making sense?
Yeah, I'm listening and absorbing that. There's something fundamental about engagement and connection that works beyond our rational thought processes of how you're working out a conflict. And I think in that engagement, we can recognize each other's humanity.
Right.
And not easily. It usually flies, in my experience, my personal experience, flies in the face of something I hold really dear, or else I wouldn't be in that conflict.
Right. Right.
To begin with.
I think, we have intellectual answers, we have emotional attachments, but we also have bodies, and we communicate with all three. And we're often not taught how to communicate well with all three. We have a common story. Knowing how to read a person's body language, sometimes I can know how far to push and when I need to step back. And I was teaching at McCormick, which is a maximum security residence for youth who've been young men who've been teenagers who've been convicted of serious crimes, and I could see where that was going to go too far, and I generally didn't push it too far. But sometimes they who are so much in their bodies and have gotten into trouble because they didn't know how to manage it need that engagement to feel like you're taking them seriously, and they will respect it. But not if you dominate them entirely, and not if you ignore them.
Right.
And that's we don't know. So much of academia are intellectuals who are trying to make the rational, convincing argument, or politicians playing on your emotions, or religious leaders playing on your emotions. But it's also just learning how to live with yourself in your body and in your heart and in your mind, and bringing those three together. And that's part of why I do this show, is because oftentimes we come to those points where we see how a life has changed because people have become more integrated in those three ways of knowing.
Yeah, I'd agree.
I'm going to do the station ID because it's required. Mm-hmm. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Tom Rossetti. I brought up McCormick, and the first time I ever heard about you, I was invited to come and watch a presentation of kids using lawnmowers.
Uh-huh.
And it may have been, I don't know, your second year, I don't know when it was, but there were two or three really proud young men who had taken apart and reassembled a simple lawnmower. What connected you to McCormick, and why do you get involved there?
Well, that's a great question. The connection was simpler than I would have ever imagined, and it was just a combination of two friends. One is a friend of mine from the Rochester area, Stuart, who has been involved in the Quaker Alternatives to Violence in Prison project for many years, and was persistently trying to get me engaged in that, and I was interested, and yet something in me didn't quite click in those times and those opportunities. And then about 4 years ago, perhaps, there was a fellow, Monty Berman. He's since moved from the area.
Yep, he was he's gone back to Pennsylvania.
Or Asheville or someplace, really something like that. Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, really interesting fellow in his mid-80s now. And he was at the time on a community advisory board for McCormick Center. He's been a very active board. That's a story in itself. And at the time, they were looking for some vocational educational opportunities. And I think someone mentioned small engine repair. Mm-hmm. I saw it on a listserv where he had posted that, and I just thought, well, I could do that, and wasn't sure I wanted to do that, but I thought I could do that, and that thought lingered, and I made the connection with him, and one thing led to another, and you know, my formal training was as a mechanical engineer, but I've also just worked with my hands and worked on mechanical stuff all my life and love tools.
When you grow up in a gritty town like you did in Pennsylvania, that's part of becoming a young man.
That's all that, and when stuff broke, when you know, you had to fix it, I had to fix it, and so as is often the case, sometimes in life's leading, sometimes it's the things that you don't have to think about a whole lot. And so we just dived into it with a couple of fellows, bought some tools, and the local Agway donated a few engines that were, you know, broken but repairable, and we started working, and that was. That's been really rich. What you talked about engagement, it was really important. And what I found was that that just simply being guys working together on a piece of equipment was a very simple way to meet these fellows at a common level, and for them to meet me at that level, and. Working on something like an engine is really objective. It either goes back together and works when you're done with it, or it doesn't.
Right.
And
feedback is immediate.
Feedback is immediate, and it's objective, and there's not a right or wrong, and things like that. And then the other thing, I think men and women share this to some extent, but men, you know, I think we're saner. I'm saner when I'm working with my hands. You know, when I'm doing something with my hands, fixing something or working on a violin or something like that, you know, it just calms the beast inside in me. And so I just sort of relied on that, and with a lot of what you were saying, just the sort of the body English, and you know, some of the joy is that a lot of these fellows have never had that kind of mentoring.
Right. They never had those relationships.
They never had those relationships. They never had anybody look at them and look at a piece of work they did and just say simply and objectively, good work. Just those two words. Yeah. And then, you know, what you see at the end of, you know, the period of time working on these things is that two things. One is that, you know, they might crack a smile.
Right.
And it's just genuine pleasure at work well done and time well spent with other men.
Right. And it's work worth doing.
Yeah.
Good work means all of three of those things.
Yeah. And it leads them to greater skills, and they know that at some level, even to the point I said it may not lead to a job. It could, but, you know, it's just if you're back home and you have an engine that breaks, and you could fix it yourself rather than having to pay somebody. So, you know, you build a little bit of just self-reliance.
Right. And self-esteem built on substance and not on other people's stroking.
Right. Yeah, it builds itself from within. And so we're trying to expand that program into the regular curriculum of the teaching curriculum of McCormick Center, which probably most people in the audience don't realize, you know, has a teaching mandate and has
they run a full middle school and high school program they're required to.
With a strongly dedicated staff who is working within the means they have to give all these fellows an opportunity for education, both academic and vocational. So,
Yeah, and one of the things that we do not realize that while we don't have the census now that we could, but we've at various points had up to 2,000 beds for incarcerated youth in Tompkins County between the four residential programs or five that we've had here over the years. Now, McCormick maxes out at about 60, but they usually have around 30 or 40, sometimes less.
Yeah.
But these are kids who have been, who have done some rough stuff and who've been through rough stuff. And there's a dedicated group. In full disclosure, I'm now an organization that helps with that community advisory board to continue to fund those kinds of efforts and to encourage them in the community.
I learned something interesting about myself in that process, too, and that is that I can have a tendency to really be trying to overwork major decisions or involvements and balancing my time. And that aspect that I told you about of how it just happened, it just sort of evolved, was important. And then at some point, some people on the board were recapping how the program had gone, and some people were asking, well, you know, what did you get from it? I think the intent was to be able to, you know, come up with a few authentic sound bites that could help recruit other people to be doing these kinds of things.
Right.
And that really stopped me in my tracks. I didn't know how to answer. Mm-hmm. And the best I could do was that because of how it all just kind of evolved out of what I do, who I am, who the people were who invited me, and the trust that I built with some of the staff there who showed me how to walk into a potentially mm-hmm. fearful environment and do these kinds of things safely. The best answer I could come up with was it was just the pleasure of doing what I could at the time, at the right time.
Right.
And I've still mulled over that it's not normally how I measure pleasure. But there was something about just being in the right place at the right time and somehow being able to just act on that. That I still go back to and try and figure out how to do more of that.
When you described this initially, you said you got this, you heard this thing, and it just kind of sat with you. And how I almost interrupted you to say, how long did it sit with you before you acted on it or before it came up again?
Must have been just a few weeks in that mm-hmm. situation. Mm-hmm. But there was just this sort of intrinsic, simply, let's just do that. And I'm not an incredibly altruistic person by nature, I don't think. I don't think of myself as a do-gooder like I regard other people who seem to build their whole lives around that. And so I think that was kind of interesting to me, mm-hmm. was that is there something about the connection and the invitation and what your skills are mm-hmm. at a certain time that maybe if you just relax,
right.
it happens.
Can I digress for a second?
Yeah.
One of the skills that I learned about recruiting volunteers was approach them with something that was close to what they already were doing,
uh-huh.
and then to say to them, let me make you an offer you can refuse. And you can refuse it. There is no, this is what's needed, this is what's possible, or this is what I see, and I think there might be a fit here. So let me know, and just let me know one way or the other. And if it doesn't work, it's fine. I may ask you again, but to keep the stakes low, so that you discover those people in those moments in their lives when, yeah, I could do that.
Yeah.
And it's just offhand. Heroic do-gooders generally, in my experience, do more bad than good, and oftentimes people who are heroic do-gooders can't be served by others. And that was kind of another rule I had. If you haven't allowed yourself to be helped through a crisis, helped through whatever, then you're probably not ready to do a whole lot with others, because you need to know what it's like to be just in this awkward space where we're trying to work something out.
No, that's interesting. That's probably worth a whole nother hour on the radio, you know. But I think there are some heroic do-gooders that I have deep admiration for.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is I don't really know what's going on inside them. And for them, maybe it isn't so much of the heroic stuff. It may well be that their level of engagement with life and the issue is at such a high level that it appears heroic in a way.
Well,
but it is.
You can see if a person is centered or if they're sweating it. And when they're centered, centered. Uh-huh. They are aware of the kinds of things you were talking about earlier, the other people's reactions and the complexity of it all,
yeah.
the good and evil and yeah. the mix of it all. And if they are sweating too much, then they may be overreaching. Now, it's important in times in life to overreach because then you learn what your limits are. But hopefully in those overreachings, we don't take too many people down.
Yeah, I can see what you're saying. For me, it's one or two guys face to face, and that's yeah. that's my level of engagement. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah. And that's close to your soul. At least that's what I would see. Let's cut to some music. What would you like to go to next?
Let's go to some singing in from Benin. Ajahn Huayta, about 2 years ago, an elder about 87 years old, singing after some manioc peeling with the community around him.
Wow.
Oops.
Hold it. Okay, we got okay.
Yeah. Might be a different track there.
Be it's five. We want to track five.
Yeah, let's try that.
It's playing the wrong track for me.
Let's see.
And those were the sounds of spontaneous singing breaking out among those peeling manioc and preparing manioc in Benin. And our guest, Tom Rossetti, recorded those sounds kind of spontaneously while you were traveling in Benin.
Right. It was 2 years ago. I was there with a friend who had been in the Peace Corps and keeps a wonderful, rich relationship with her friends in this village of Ajahn Huayta, which still, after all these years, has no electricity, and people live in some interesting mix of very traditional subsistence farming and some cash jobs, but then mixed with cell phones and all the other kinds of infiltrations. But it was a wonderful 3 weeks, and we just spent the time there. And I found it rich in a lot of ways. One was that the national language is French. The indigenous language in southern Benin is Fon, and I knew neither of those languages, and yet the connection and warmth of the villagers and how they expressed that towards me and as a friend of somebody they knew was just extraordinary. And I just sort of dove into learning the language, and found out that it was an endless source of connection and mirth. I mean, it was just hilarious, you know, how they found my attempts at speaking their language, right? And there are people who just love to laugh, and it's a very difficult life by any standards, not just by comparison to American standards, and yet there is so much joy, much spontaneous joy would just erupt. And so much real connection, face to face, body language in the eyes and gestures and offerings. And yeah,
the standard spiritual saying is that those who know great joy have known great suffering. Uh-huh. That your capacity for one is the mirror of the other.
Yeah.
So the more that life has wrung out of you, the more that you can ring back into life.
Boy, they certainly have got their sorrows that they deal with.
But we don't, when we want to make things easy, we also take away the wonder.
Yeah.
And the kind of sense of resilience that is important. And people who live in those sorts of settings, as you're describing them, are nothing if they're not resilient.
Yeah.
And not always, because sometimes people die or fail. All sorts of things happen.
Yeah, humanity happens there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was go ahead. The other interesting connection for me is musical, and that is that this southern old time music that I play, a lot of people have described as sort of where, you know, the northern Celtic traditions of fiddling and so forth filtered their way down through the Appalachians and encountered African American banjos and rhythms, and as they just sort of melted together in the hills, isolated from other influences, out came, you know, this southern old time fiddle tradition. And it was really interesting to just hear firsthand some of the ways that the Beninese made music, and put the two of them together and so forth. And I love the rhythms that Papa just started tapping out. He just had a key or something on a bottle, and then there was this call and response aspect of the music that was so typical of everything I heard there, and just incredible joy with the music,
right.
That was part of it there too. So took a mandolin over, and what I found out was that they couldn't quite get the kind of music we played, bits and pieces of it, but there was a fellow there who is passing on the traditions of their music to the next generation, the kids. It's a really, really wonderful fellow, Nestor. And what he was interested in was beginning to play their music on the mandolin. So we left a mandolin with him.
Wow.
And he was then, figuring out, you know, how to play their melodies there. And so who knows where he went with that. But, you know, music is just another one of those really common bonders. And
yeah. Do you sing when you work?
Do I sing? I always think I can't sing in general, so not so much. But I've always got a tune running through my head.
Yeah.
I always got a tune running through my head.
Yeah. I grew up in that same kind of environment, only we sang while we worked around the house or on the farm or whatever. And that's part of that that rural American tradition of making it happen while you do it.
Oh, I love that. The Beninese would sing a lot, and I've been around.
We associate it, because we're so far from our roots as white folk, we associate it with an African-American tradition, but it was also true very strongly of the white working, because the singing sets a pace for the work, and it also sets a coordination of the work, so that it all, and then it allows the work to have multiple feelings and multiple expressions.
Yeah.
Powerful. Now, One of the ways we come to kind of toward the last segment of the show is we kind of talk about, you know, what do you do to restore yourself?
That's a tricky question. That was one of the ones that I was, you sent a few questions out ahead of time, and then that one, the one about optimism, were the two that challenged me the most.
Right.
And
tell me about the challenge.
I think the challenge is that I've always had a tumultuous inner life, mm-hmm. and have always had to and continue to have to work with that, mm-hmm. and so I don't always restore balance. I think that was part of the question there, was how do you restore balance, and I don't always achieve that.
Right, and I guess words do not do well, because it's not how do you maintain engagement, in other words, with your inner life.
Yeah, that's a combination of just sort of going through all the avenues. One is music, mm-hmm. and I say thank God for old time music, to be able to sit down and play music for 3 or 4 or 5 hours with friends is one of the keys to it. And another is a kind of a meditative practice, mm-hmm. That has evolved over time. And
what is the meditative practice?
That's worth another hour. I think it's partly.
Well, the reason I ask these kind of simple how-to questions, or how did it change, or how did it get started, or what is that a lot of us make reference to things that we do, but we never really explain them, so they don't become things that we can learn from others or share.
Yeah.
And so much of what each person I've interviewed has a unique approach to what mm-hmm. they do, and they've almost always cobbled it together. About a third of them have a really set pattern in their lives, and about two thirds kind of do it when it seems important. So what have you discovered about meditation, and how has it evolved?
First, that it's essential. That if I neglect it, it's not optional for me. It's not something like window dressing or another. It must be done. Mm-hmm. It's come out of kind of a practical mindfulness as part of it, mm-hmm. and that is, I noticed at some point in life what I spoke of earlier, that when I was working on something, I was a saner human being. And so part of that, I think, is just the presence of what mindfulness really is just being here, doing something, and being connected physically, mm-hmm. To your immediate presence. And you can cultivate that through all sorts of different, more formal mindfulness practices, and that's part of it. And the other is, I'd done a series of silent retreats about 15 years ago, mm-hmm. and out of, a week of silent retreat, some experiences and insights came, sort of crashing in, that underneath all of who I thought I am, there's just some simple presence that's in all of us. And I think every major religion has evokes that or tries to describe it in one way or another, and I'm not even going to try to attach a word to it.
But you did presence. It's being...
It's just, I think, our fundamental, human life, maybe beyond human, just our fundamental life presence is something that, gradually becomes palpable. And I begin to practice and find that if I can just sort of withdraw into that, or just sort of not necessarily withdraw, but just step back a little bit from what my mind is inventing is going on emotionally in a particular situation, and just settle into here and now, this tune right now, for example, or this conversation, that's something that's reliable. Maybe the only thing that's reliable inside my conscious experience.
Well, it is certainly what is now.
Yeah.
And you're completely with the other person rather than off on some other agenda or withdrawn or in a different time zone.
And that whatever that is, and I'm not going to even try and name it. I mean, whatever that light is or something, it's the core of love. Or it's the source of it, or it's embodied out of it. And somehow, the more I remember that, and the more I just try to consciously relax into that, then the more human I can manage to be, and the more connected.
Right. How did you learn, kind of when and how did you learn to take care that taking care of yourself was something that mattered.
Still learning that.
Yeah. Well, you're learning it, but somewhere early on, it became something to work on or to pay attention to. How did you become aware of that? You may have already been doing it, but how did you become aware of it?
I'm a boneheaded learner, and for me,
most of us are.
It came from crashing out and finding that the alternative was just too hard, and I tend to relearn that periodically, yeah. And then remember that I just have to.
What is it? You crash out on your own agenda, or you crash out on not watching yourself and taking care of yourself?
It could be a whole mix of things. I mean, my most recent one has been taking work really too seriously and getting wrapped around the axle about some of those things. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, when my blood pressure's up and I'm being irritable and short with other people, or, you know, all the things we do when we're not in balance.
Right. Not sleeping and all sorts of stuff.
All that stuff, dreaming about, you know, solar electric circuits and my sleep and so forth, you know, then,
right.
Then, you know, eventually the signs catch up and I realize that I've got to try to do something different. And
I don't know a lot of engineers who take week-long silent retreats.
Yeah.
That's a powerful experience. I've known a number of Jesuits and Buddhists and Christian contemplatives and others. How did you discover silence?
It was just at a particularly difficult point in my life, and I was living in Rochester at the time, and read about something called Zen Buddhism, and mm-hmm. found out that there was quite a center of that in Rochester, and then as there was a footnote about a place in Springwater, New York, a little south of Rochester. It's called Springwater Center, mm-hmm. and it was a bit of a splinter group off of the Rochester Zen Center, and there were just sort of no trappings, no dogma, no ritual. It was just sitting, and
I've heard of that center. Yes.
And that spareness really attracted me, mm-hmm. and it was the best thing for my mind, because getting all wrapped up in trying to sort out the different rituals and dogmas of things has always been a trap for me, and so I went, and it was one of the pivotal experiences of my life. Changed me.
Yeah. It helped. I mean, it sounds like. When we try to be thoughtful, too often we force ourselves to be intellectual, and that gets us dogmatic and tied up in knots. But when we're thoughtful and we try to be wise, then we slow down. And we don't live in a culture that encourages us to grow in thoughtfulness in a way that is wise, grounded in our minds and hearts and bodies. And it seems you've discovered that. Or discovering that
I rediscover it. Yeah.
Every day. I want to celebrate it, because we often don't celebrate those things.
Right.
Tom, it has been an absolute delight to get to know you.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed the conversation.
We have one last song, and it's you and friends playing fiddle music.
It's and again, I'm not the fiddler, but really enjoying it.
Okie doke.
Yeah.
And that was Going to Town. And our guest on this past hour was Tom Russetti.